Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. It's the last in the current series and our featured guest today is Ian Hood, talking about his debut novel, This Good Book. We'll also hear from Joanne Lindbergh chatting about her new memoir-based series of essays, Letters to My Weird Sisters on Autism and Feminism. And Sunday Times bestseller Paige Toon talks to us about her latest novel, Someone I Used to Know. Ian, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but first of all, welcome to Bookmark.
Yes, thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Now, as I said, this is the last in the series of Bookmark, but this is the first novel for you, your debut novel, This Good Book. Mm-hmm. What was your route to publication?
I have been writing for quite a few years and had tried the traditional routes, shall we say, of getting an agent. Also, because it has been a few years, I was fairly used to spotting small publishers that took unsolicited manuscripts directly. But in the end up, what actually happened was that I read a book by an author called Tom McCarthy and enjoyed his book so much that I looked into the publisher of that book and sent a novel, not actually This Good Book, another novel to that publisher, who chose not to publish it, but the reader of the book had a very positive response to it. Eventually, actually, he left that publisher to form Renard Press, and we got back in touch with each other and started talking about plans for books I'd like to write and he'd like to publish.
So working with a small press, you're quite involved then in the production of the book?
Yeah. Although for This Good Book, I had got to a place of editing it that Will was pretty happy about, although we still ended up doing a lot of editing and proofing, and it gets very intricate. It's a small independent publisher. He has a classics list, but I think I was the first alive writer that he signed up. If you get your hands on a hardback, it's actually hand-produced by Will on his own press. So it's a very artisan product.
Well, we're going to talk to you a lot about, obviously, about This Good Book, but we'll hear your first choice of music now. Before we do that, is music important to you, Ian?
I'm one of those writers who has to get the playlist of the music in place before I actually start writing. For This Good Book specifically, it grows out of a great love I have of the Glasgow band Mogwai. Mogwai are actually involved in the plot, and Mogwai song lyrics are woven into the text. So, yes, I love music, and it shows in my writing. The other thing about it is, if you tell me that a character wears a green coat, I get nowhere with that. But if you tell me that they are a person who loves Jeff Buckley but hates Tim Buckley, then I know exactly who they are. Maybe I shouldn't be making judgments like that, but I'm clearing my head as to who people are if I know what their musical tastes are.
Yeah, so we've got three Mogwai tracks ahead of us, but we're going to start with the first track, which is Yes, I'm a Long Way From Home. Why this one in particular?
When you hear the track, you'll hear a woman's voice speaking, which Mogwai, they are a band that mostly produce instrumental music, but they also use a human voice in different ways, sometimes simply singing a song, but often just using human voice noises or sounds. In the novel, the main character, Susan Allison, experiences a strange, ecstatic visions or possibly seizures during which she hears Mogwai songs playing in her ears. This is at a time even before Mogwai have formed. It's a strange little supernatural part of the book. She tries to explain it herself, but she can't. In the book, what she's doing is repeating the words that are at the start of Yes, I Am a Long Way From Home. The second part of it is that as the two characters, the two artists, stand in front of Dali's The Christ of St. John of the Cross, which I think most people know that image. It's a kind of floating crucifixion above a seascape. The Christ figure appears in the sky. It's not quite the earth. and it's not quite space. The male character, Douglas, says what it makes him feel is, yes, I am a long way from home.
I know one thing. On Saturday, the sky will crumble together or something, with a huge bang, to fit into the day.
That was Yes, I Am a Long Way From Home by Mogwai, the first choice of music on today's bookmark from our featured guest, Ian Hood. Ian's debut novel, This Good Book, was published this month, and already short story writer Colette Paul has said of it, "This Good Book is a novel about Glasgow, about art, about obsession. It will have you gripped from the opening chapter to its disturbing conclusion." Ian Hood is an original new voice in Scottish fiction. I'll come back to that quote later, in particularly the part about Scottish fiction. But to add my voice to that, I enjoyed it very much. It's highly original. But first of all, before we talk in depth about it, what's it about? It's about lots of different ideas, but in terms of the plot, what's it about without giving anything away?
The novel's about two artists, graduates of the Glasgow School of Art. The trajectory of the novel follows their careers as they try to create the best art that they can. And the ideas that are being engaged with are ideas of good or bad art, great or not great art. The idea of the best kind of art that they can produce, which inevitably they learn is illusory in a certain way. Susan Allison is the artist who wants to create a crucifixion scene, and she wants to use... And she does use Douglas, the other artist, as the model for Christ in this depiction of the crucifixion. She narrates throughout, and it's her description, explanation, and maybe apology and a confession of what has happened between the two of them as they try to create the best art they can create.
And why the crucifixion in particular? Because you could have had him posing in anything. Why the crucifixion?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because throughout, although the novel doesn't engage with ideas of theology and religion and morality and art, which makes it sound extremely heavy, it is a funny book, I hope, as well. One of the start points for writing the novel actually was that if you live in a Christian society and probably were yourself brought up Christian, then that is the key story that you have to deal with. We may all know many narratives, but the one that is deepest ingrained in us and we have to somehow reconcile a meaning from is the passion of Jesus Christ, or in a wider context, the Bible itself.
And there is a lot of art in it. Obviously, the two central characters are art. There's a lot of talk about art and modern art in particular. Is that a subject that you're interested in?
Yeah, I enjoy going to galleries and enjoy looking at art. I don't have many preconceived ideas. I can enjoy two colours of a Rothko as much as a landscape of Scotland, you know. I'm interested most of all in the ideas that art expresses.
And you're pushing our sort of understanding or our acceptance of modern art, because one of the central characters, his modern art is filling bags with urine and then selling them vast amounts of money and winning huge art prizes. Were you having a pop at modern art there, or were you trying to say something bigger?
No. I wanted the reader to think, oh my God, what is this art expressing? And is it expressing anything? And is it shallow or is it deep? And what is the art world saying when they start praising it to high heaven? And it was all of those things. It was all of the things about, say, Damien Hirst being on TV now painting flowers in lockdown after chopping sharks and cows in half. What does that reversal mean? What does it mean for Tracy Emin to put her bed in a gallery space? Why does that look shallow, but why might it not be? I suppose, yeah, at the start of the novel, it's almost I invite the reader to laugh at the idea of urine in bags, that his artistic medium, and then I'm hoping that by the end of the book, something other than that is happening. I'm not just inviting laughter.
You said you hope the book is funny. It's funny. It is darkly funny in parts. There's a lot of humour in the language, in the use of language. Some of it is in dialect. You are playing with that as well?
Yeah. The main character, Susan Allison, is accused in the book of changing her dialect to suit her purposes of moving from the Western Isles down into Glasgow, and whether she's trying to ingratiate herself or fit in. I would actually put forward the idea that she speaks in a kind of Mogwaiese. Mogwai are famous for having these kind of... one of the song titles from their latest album is Mum, It's What I Want to Do. Another example of a title is The Sun Smells Too Loud. They're often misheard things that the band, when they're talking amongst themselves and with their friends, they hear these strange little phrases. They like using malapropism. Oh, I can't say that word.
Well, there's an irony. Malapropisms.
Yeah. So they like using these misheard phrases. One of the enjoyable games in the writing of the book was to make those not always comprehensible phrases make more sense within the plot, so that when someone shouts out the sun smells too loud, it's because they've just been burnt. So that I actually twisted the plot around the song titles. And so, yes, Douglas and Susan Allison's speak with a Glasgow accent, and in some senses they speak with a Glasgow accent specific to my experience of it from the late 1980s through to the present day, because everyone has little things they pick up. But anyone who's ever listened to a teenager knows that they like neologisms of their own construction so that other hearers can't follow them. That's the point of it. But she has this idiolect that is part Western Isles, part Glaswegian, lots of Mogwaiese.
And she, obviously, it's written in the first person, so you're writing as a woman, you're writing as an artist, a female artist, and as a female artist who has, as you said, seizures or visions. It's quite a challenge.
I don't know that I always agree with that. The book seeks you out. I'm not too convinced of those sort of ideas. I'm much more of a materialist than this, in which the writer has more agency. But I do know certain things. I do know that, say, you'd reverse the genders, and it was a male artist doing a crucifixion scene with a female, the issues that you're then dealing with are much different. And even if, say, you had two male characters, then somehow the dynamic is not only very different, but from my purposes, wrong. The book wouldn't have worked in that sense. But I am willing to say those sort of things, like Susan Allison is a woman because she just is. The character came to me quite fully formed.
And the visions, the seizures, the ecstatic visions, when did they come to you that they would be part of her character? Why was that important?
Quite early on in the planning of the book. They kind of grew out of Jane Rogers' Mr. Rose Fortunes. If you know the Martha narratives within that book, she would be called a woman with a learning disability in the present day, but when the book's set, she's put down as being called a simpleton or whatever. But her vision works by ecstatic language, fire, light, water, simple, direct, and yet it says something about another world. I just knew there would be something like that in there.
Thank you, Ian. Well, we'll stay with misunderstood women, actually, and we'll hear from Joanne Lindberg now about her book. Joanne is a poet, memoirist and novelist. She's published 3 poetry collections, and her first, Feminismo, was shortlisted for the Forward Prize for Best First Collection. The Woman Who Thought Too Much, a memoir about OCD, anxiety and poetry, came out in 2011, followed by a second memoir, Small Pieces, a Book of Lamentations. Letters to My Weird Sisters on Autism and Feminism was published this month, and Through Letters explores the links between Joanne and the women of the past and the ways that creative and sometimes eccentric women have been exiled to the edges. When I spoke to Joanne, I asked her when she was first diagnosed as autistic.
My diagnosis was in September 2012 when I was 42, but I pretty well self-diagnosed about a year earlier, after a lifetime of knowing there was something going on and feeling sort of drawn to the whole idea of autism, but never finding myself matching any of the clinical descriptions, really. And I had, as a child, been sort of picked up on for having sort of social problems and for working in an unusual way at school and for stammering. But none of that had ever been connected. And as an adult, I'd been diagnosed with various mental health issues. But it was only at that point, at 42, that I got the answer. Things fall into place. Things start to make sense that they didn't make before. And certain aspects of my character or my habits or my ways of thinking or my ways of perceiving things, I now had an explanation for them. I was also able to be more compassionate towards myself and not push myself to do things that I knew were difficult for me. So I wrote a series of poems called The Autistic Alice, using the figure of Lewis Carroll's Alice to explore my autistic experience before I was diagnosed. I wanted to think about it more. I got very interested in the essay form, and I wanted to do something with that. I just had a question in my head, especially having read Steve Silberman's book, Neurotribes, where he looks at people like Henry Cavendish and Nikola Tesla. And he doesn't diagnose them because you can't diagnose someone who's no longer here and who you're not qualified to diagnose. But he speculates about their neurodivergence, I guess. And I thought, where were the women? And how did this affect them? So I started looking for women, and I looked at witches and I looked at nuns and I looked at anchoresses, and they were one of my many sort of cul-de-sacs. But in the end, I came up with 4 women. Virginia Woolf, who I really hadn't wanted to write about for so many reasons, but when I read her autobiographical work, it felt unavoidable. But I know that when someone's a sort of exceptional cultural figure, people can be quite protective of them. So I'm very, very careful with what I say about her, but there were so many of her experiences of being out of place, especially when she was a young woman in very conventional society, of looking wrong, of having the wrong demeanour, of having the wrong sort of speech. To some extent, this persisted through her life and she found it very painful. But I think it also gave her the outsider's perspective that made her question the way we live and examine it minutely. There is an autistic reading of her life that her life supports, just like one might give it a queer reading, for example. After her, there's Adelheid Bloch. Adelheid was, I think, non-speaking or had very limited speech. And she was a German Jew born in the early part of last century. And she was one of the people the Nazis killed under their Action T4 program, whereby they tried to purge disabled children and adults from the population. That was very painful to write for obvious reasons. And then there's Frau V. No one really knows who Frau V was, but she appears with that pseudonym in Hans Asperger's classic paper about autistic psychopathy as the parent of one of his patients. And there's a wonderful description of her eccentricity. So I use her to explore motherhood. And then the last one is another mother. She's Johannes Kepler's mother, Katharina Kepler, who was put on trial for witchcraft. It doesn't seem to be the case that people who were accused of witchcraft were necessarily outsiders. It was a way of shopping your neighbour. All sorts of people got pulled into it. But when I read the notes about Katharina, and there were wonderful detailed notes because Johannes defended her himself, She seemed quite neurodivergent, and it seemed also quite likely that the mother of an astronomer and mathematician would be. I think it made me realise just how difficult things had been, because for years, when it goes on, you kind of squash it down. And I realised through them just how much work I've been doing to try and present quote-unquote normal front. And in the final essay, the one to Katharina Kepler, I really do examine that persona I've developed to pass. And I'm sort of more critical of myself and more challenging to myself because I put that persona in its class and race context. And also in the context of being an autistic person who can pass, because I do have speech and I can just about, with a lot of effort, make my face do what people think faces should do and so on. So I have sort of a passing privilege that autistic people who can't do that don't. And I thought about, by choosing to pass, am I just serving to reinforce certain norms that exclude people and that are damaging to people? So that sudden turning around and looking at myself took me by surprise. I was glad I did it. I've learned to put in enough that I can get across what I'm trying to get across, while, you know, not telling everything. I think in my first book, The Woman Who Thought Too Much, looking back, I feel like I did overshare, which is not to say that I didn't write it in good faith or that I regret it. But I've learned then that you, and I always tell my memoir students as a creative writing teacher, you don't owe your reader absolutely everything. You don't have to tell them everything. Tell them what you need to address the theme that you're addressing. And that's what I've learned to do. And I'm also careful, and have been all the way through, with the privacy of people around me. That's quite an important determining factor in what I talk about. I'm a writer, first of all. I was a writer before I was autistic. And what I want is to produce something that's a piece of good writing. So I hope people that are interested in good writing would read it. And also people who are interested in feminist ideas. Because one of the things I address is how feminism has tended to sideline, or in fact even ignore, disabled women, in particular intellectually disabled women. And we need to address that, and also address motherhood in a more complex way, and caring in a more complex way. You can let the shape of the thought and the shape of the idea determine the shape of the essay. I mean, that's what lyric essay means to me. It has that sort of formal concentration that poetry has, but in prose. I really enjoy being able to get my ideas out there in the shape that I experience them. And it's the form that you can do that in.
And Letters to My Weird Sisters on Autism and Feminism by Joanne Lindberg is published by Atlantic Books. Our featured guest on Bookmark today is Ian Hudd, talking about his debut novel, This Good Book. So staying around that personal theme that Joanne was talking about there. So your characters are Scottish, you're Scottish. They're studying in Glasgow. You studied in Glasgow, written with a Glaswegian lil. And Colette Paul described it at the beginning as Scottish fiction, part of the Scottish fiction tradition. I mean, my question is, how Scottish is this book? But also, is there such a thing as Scottish fiction, do you think? How do you feel about that description?
I love Scottish literature, and I feel as though that a writer, generally speaking, has to grow out of some sort of specificity in literature, although I love Latin American writers. And the two biggest collections of books in my bookshelf are Irish writers and American writers. There is a Scottish shelf. Oh, there's two Scottish shelves now. I'm looking at them. I do love those writers. In the sense of the local community, for us in Cambridge, I love the writing of Ali Smith, and I've read all her novels and many of the short stories. There's also a tradition that I'm trying to write in specifically, which engages with ideas of language and how dialect is constructed and manipulated. So writers like Alistair Gray and Jim Kelman were really important to me. I also love the short stories of Colette Paul, who happens to also live in Cambridge now. So yeah, Scottish literature, it means a lot to me. I mean, I love Kazuo Ishiguro, our Nobel laureate, as well. So it's not as if I'm exclusively interested in Scottish writing, but it's just the place that I come from. It just has my accent. You know, this isn't my natural accent. When I'm in Scotland, I sound a lot more Scottish. But I can't start saying, well, I'm not Scottish anymore because I've lived in England for so long. I just am. And that's the literary tradition that I grew out of.
And is there a distinct voice in Scottish literature? Do you think, are there distinct ideas explored and messages?
I think there are. Jim Kelman has this very politicised about who gets to speak. The writers of the 70s and 80s in Glasgow and in Scotland was very much a reaction against the narrative voice in Scottish novels that was a fairly tempered, anglicised version of itself, where you got a sort of phonetic or different type of Scottish accent was in the dialogue. And their point was a political point about who gets to possess the story. You know, if you have to flatten your language in the narrative for descriptive passages or moving the plot along, and then when people speak, they speak in a completely different accent, why would that be? I think part of the 70s, 80s renaissance in Scottish literature was about saying that the Scottish voice can be used in all arenas of literature to express, you know, ideas. We're all children of the Scottish Enlightenment. Why don't we get to possess ideas more than most?
In terms of geography and time-wise, this novel is set in, well, from really the 1980s to the early 2000s in Glasgow. Was that a particular period of time that you knew the city well?
I graduated in 1987 from Glasgow University. So 1988, 89, those were years when I was living in Glasgow. I moved out eventually in 1993, moved to England. In some senses, when we were proofreading the book on the fact-checking front, certain things that I remember, you know, there's certain cafes that have had 12 different names in the last 25 years, but I still remember them as the name they had in 1988, because to me that's still real. I mean, I go back and visit Glasgow quite often, but somehow the clarity of what Glasgow was like then remains in my head, because it's compared against living in Cambridge for the last 20 years. And although I know all the changes that are taking place in Cambridge, I don't really know what's taking place in Glasgow. The previous book, the one that got the interest of Will, the publisher, in the first place, had a little section in it about two young people in Glasgow in the 80s. And that was one of the seeds of this good book, the book I then went on to write, because I just so enjoyed actually writing that little love story of two people young and in love and in Glasgow in the 80s. So that I wanted to write another, a different kind of story, because although there are two characters in this good book, Susan Allison and Douglas, they're never in a relationship with each other. It's not about that.
We're going to hear now your second choice of music, How to Be a Werewolf by Mogwai. Where does this fit into all that?
How to Be a Werewolf is, again, a title that's used in the book woven into the text. Mogwai were the gift that kept on giving in terms of their titles when I was writing it. In fact, the very first plan I had for this good book was just a list of about 50 Mogwai song titles. The thing about How to Be a Werewolf as well is that I've written for a long time. I've always written to plans and structures. I'm a planner. But I don't know that I ever had as clear an idea of narrative flow, the twists and turns of a plot, until I'd actually heard How to Be a Werewolf. There are no lyrics, and yet somehow Mogwai managed to tell a story within that song. You're taken along with it to a peak, to a crescendo, and then an end point where you're just kind of dropped off. There's a dying fall in this good book. The last five chapters are much shorter than the previous 10. I was learning narrative structure by hearing How to Be a Werewolf.
Thank you.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Join me, Neil Jones, every Tuesday here on Cambridge 105 Radio for the very best from the world of rock. Every week we'll bring you big name interviews, all the latest from the local scene here in Cambridge, and the very best rock songs around. It's 2 hours of rock every single Tuesday from 9 o'clock with me, Neil Jones, right here across the city in South Cambridgeshire on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Need dropping off at work? Missed the bus and must make that urgent appointment? Need picking up after a night out with your mates? Panther Taxis is your Cambridge-based taxi firm with over 700 drivers, offering great rates and local knowledge, ensuring you make it quickly and safely to your destination. We don't inflate our prices at peak times, and all our drivers accept payments by cash or card. Book your taxi the easy way. Download our free Panther Taxis app through your app store and start booking your taxis on the go. Call Cambridge 715 715 or see panthertaxis.co.uk. Panther Taxis, your local, quick, reliable and friendly taxi company in the city.
CKLG Accountants are a friendly team of accountants and tax advisors with big firm expertise.
I'm Sarah, one of CKLG's friendly tax advisors. Creating and preserving wealth is an aspiration for many of our clients. In our complex world of changing legislation and family circumstances, we listen and provide you and your family with bespoke tax advice tailored to your needs.
To find out more, call us on Cambridge 810 100 to arrange an initial chat with one of our specialists, or visit our website cklg.co.uk.
CKLG Accountants, your partner in business, your partner in life.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our featured guest on Bookmark today is Ian Hutt, talking about his debut novel, This Good Book. Ian, as we've alluded to, there's a lot about the crucifixion and art in This Good Book. I learnt a lot about crucifixion painting, I have to say, and wondered what kind of research you had to do on this.
Yeah, listening to 4 billion hours of Mogwai is one answer. But also, yeah, no, I mean, I knew many images. And of course, the Ur text, it's called in the novel, is Christ of St. John of the Cross. I don't think somehow, as a Glasgow-born writer who's visited Christ of St. John of the Cross and the Glasgow Art Galleries as many times as Susan Allison says she's been in front of it hundreds and maybe thousands of times. That goes for many, many people who live around Glasgow, and it certainly goes for me. And it draws you back over and over again.
This is the Dali work, yeah?
Mm-hmm, yeah, yeah, Salvador Dali, bought by the city of Glasgow many years ago. Also, there are other Scottish artists that are mentioned in it, and Craig Aitchison, for example, he's done many, many crucifixion scenes. Peter Housen is an artist who, he had a sort of revelatory experience. One of the key works at the end of This Good Book is the Ken Curry work. It's called Untitled, and as it's described in the book, it's a luminous man sort of floating in a dark space, but it has the marks of the crucifixion upon him. It was commissioned as a reinterpretation of the crucifixion story. There's all those, and then there's hundreds of other crucifixion scenes that have been painted, and then there's a set of other references in the novel about Pier Paolo Pasolini's Gospel According to St. Matthew, for example, as a movie, and The Last Temptation of Christ. And, you know, again, it goes back to that thing that in a Christian society, you have to somehow reconcile yourself to the story of the life of Christ, and especially the passion of Christ. Not only that, but those images suffuse our society, whether it's Jesus Christ Superstar or the number of churches with crosses around them, you know, that just suffuses the culture, and you have to have some sort of opinion about it. In terms of research, I then had to go start looking for certain images. They seem to come along to be useful to me, as if that was their only purpose in history.
I suppose for an artist, it's not just that reference and familiarity with the story. There's also, for the artist, which you talk about, the challenge of doing something different.
That's right. Susan Allison wants to paint something that lives up to all the previous crucifixion scenes that she looks up and references and thinks about. And she wants to do something that is as great as some of the ones that she sees, but also is in the tradition, but transcends the tradition.
And just a note about how it's written, because it's written in the present tense, but there's a lot of looking backwards and there's a lot of looking forwards and addressing the reader in a conversational tone and sometimes withholding information, giving out a little bit of information, then pulling it back in again. That obviously is a particular style of writing. You could have just told it in a straight narrative. Why did you want that sense of moving around in time and engagement with the reader?
There was a number of reasons, and it became a nightmare during proofreading, of course, because at one point I was like, how can this be happening? You find out about, for example, Douglas's work with the urine in a sort of like general way first, and then in a specific memory that Susan Allison has. She then, 20 pages later, she recounts the actual scene where she first found out that that's what his art was like. And, you know, the proofreader was doing a sterling job, but they were saying, well, you've told that story twice and all those sort of things that you shouldn't, that are real faux pas. But it's because she is working on memory. The last date, I think, or the last year that's mentioned is 2020. She's looking back upon it. So her memory isn't that good sometimes. And sometimes she manipulates her memories for her own purposes. She's a classic unreliable narrator. I fairly believe most of what she says. I think she's a pretty good storyteller. She tells a story the way her mother likes a story being told. She's rehearsed and practiced the methodology of storytelling, and she's pretty good at it. But like all of us, she's fallible. So sometimes she goes round in circles, and sometimes the chronology doesn't make sense. But the story is, it does move along in a kind of chronology.
Thank you, Ian. Well, actually, you've led me very nicely through to introducing our next guest, who is Paige Toon, Sunday Times bestseller. Paige Toon is the author of 19 novels, which have sold over 1.5 million copies worldwide. And in 2016, the one we fell in love with was selected for the W.H. Smith Zoella Book Club. Her latest, Someone I Used to Know, came out last month. And when I spoke to Paige, I started by asking her to tell me what the novel is about.
This is a story of Leah. Her parents foster. So she spent her life growing up in a house full of all these troubled teenagers coming and going. She has to share her parents with them. Sometimes these kids need her parents more than she does. And one day into their midst comes this boy called George, who is very troubled. At the age of 15, the characters also meet another boy called Theo. And basically, this is a story that's told between two different timelines. It's when they're 15 and when they're 30. And in the later years, Leah has gone on to marry Theo. George had run away at the age of 15 and he comes back into her life, you know. So there are a few twists and turns, but basically it is a love story.
Yeah, a few twists and turns there. I was looking at the reviews of this and it's a gorgeous new love story with a twist. That's quite hard having that so prominent, isn't it? How hard is it to keep the twist a surprise and a secret?
It's funny, I've only just seen that my publisher has put that up, you know. It's a tricky one because on the one hand, if you know that there's a bit of a twist, that makes it quite exciting to read. But I hate knowing that there's something coming because then you're just waiting, well, is it this? Is it that? Is it, you know, you're just sort of thinking about it the whole time. So I'm trying not to say too much about it, but, you know, it might surprise you. It might not.
Well, yes, no spoilers. And when you're writing towards the twist, it must be quite enjoyable when you get to the point where you can write that bit and turn everything upside down.
Absolutely. Really hard to talk about without kind of giving it away, yeah. But I've had a lot of readers already, you know, who've been saying, now I want to go back and read it all again, you know, just to see how it all came together.
And as you were saying, there's foster carers in this novel. How much research did you do into that scenario?
I did a lot of research into fostering. Spoke to foster parents and spoke to kids whose parents had fostered and, you know, spoke to people who worked in schools and obviously just did an awful lot of online research as well. I mean, ultimately, all of the stories that are in this novel are fictional. Only small elements were sort of drawn from reality. You know, most of it was from just a figment of my imagination, but it's all very realistic scenarios. One of the things I discovered in my research was how it's not uncommon for siblings to be separated, with younger children being put up for adoption and older children going into care. And when I discovered that really early on, well before I started writing this book, oh, it just absolutely broke my heart, you know. So that's one of the storylines, you know, that is George's situation, you know, where he's been sort of separated from his little sister. And I remember my friend telling me, she works in family court and stuff and has seen this scenario happen quite a lot. And, you know, she said to me, when the kids grow up, it's always the siblings they try and find first. You know, they try to find their siblings before their parents. So, yeah, it was something, an issue I wanted to sort of shine a light on, really.
And you're a mum yourself, aren't you? So it must trigger all those kinds of emotions about loss and connection.
Completely. I mean, this is, I would say, easily my most emotional book to date. And for me, you know, so much of that emotion comes out of this looked after children storyline. It broke my heart to know how many of these situations exist. And, you know, I did some research, you know, where I watched some videos and things of really quite inspirational foster families and foster parents. And I really wanted Leah's parents to be inspirational. You know, I've had so many readers write to me over the years who've read my books and have gone on to pursue a career and something that I might have written about. If there's a chance that this book inspires even, you know, just one reader to go on and become a foster parent, I'll cry for sure. You know, it would make me really happy. But I think one of the lovely things that I discovered through research is just how much an ordinary person can do. You know, if you don't want to foster, Leah's mum has a conversation with her and says, you know, everything that can help the bigger picture is worth doing. You know, whether you just support another foster family, maybe take them a meal occasionally, or lend an ear to a social worker, take a bit of the load off them, you know. It all just sort of helps this bigger picture. So I really loved reading that and wrote that into the story because I just thought, you know, people might feel a bit inspired to be that little bit more compassionate, perhaps.
And for a writer, it gives you an opportunity, doesn't it, having a child being fostered, to explore the connections between family and somebody from outside the family who's in the family as well.
Absolutely. I mean, in this book, there are so many different types of family. And, you know, ultimately, it's a book about love and care, which doesn't necessarily come from the places that you might expect it to. You know, like the third character, main character, Theo, you know, he's the son of a local landowner and he's a very wealthy family, normally goes to boarding school, and one day he turns up on the state school bus, you know, and he's ends up getting beaten up, and that's how the three of them bond. Theo himself, you know, he has so many problems, you know, that you just wouldn't see on the surface. It was interesting to kind of explore that. And all of the foster siblings, when George comes to live with them, there are nine of them living under the same roof. And to give each of them a voice was really important too, you know, to make sure they each had a storyline without kind of overwhelming the main story arc.
And as ever, your character's praised for being warm and likeable. How do you do that? How do you make a character warm?
I'm living inside Leah's head for 3 months as I'm writing this book. So the way I envisaged her is that she is warm. You know, she's very understanding. She's very compassionate. You know, she has had to share her home and her family with so many different kids who've come and gone. And yes, sometimes she feels a little bit bitter and overlooked. But on the whole, she's actually just really proud of her parents. I have written characters who aren't as warm. And when I read those stories now, I don't like them quite as much as others, you know. But I like each of my characters to have slightly different personalities, and ultimately, you know, whatever circumstances and, you know, whatever their backstory is dictates the sort of person that they sometimes end up being. Just as long as they're realistic, that's the thing that matters most to me.
And what book is this? What book number is this?
This is number 19.
19 books. Congratulations. That's fantastic. So you're obviously still enjoying it.
Yeah, it's my favourite thing in the world is to write. Yeah, to lose myself inside. It feels like a little movie inside my head. I want my books to feel as easy to read as, you know, to sit down and watch a really good feel-good film. My favourite time of year is September, October, November, and that's when I'm sort of sitting down and getting stuck into my next novel. So yeah, as long as everybody keeps reading, I'll keep writing, and I'll probably keep writing long after they stop reading too.
And you're not running out of ideas?
No, I've got two on the horizon for the next book, which I need to decide between.
And what's your routine, Paige? How do you discipline yourself?
My routine is that I leave things to the last minute and then I'm in a mad panic and have to write every moment I can. Joking aside, I've been thinking about this book for years, so, you know, a writer is always working. You know, I'm always thinking, I'm always, you know, having these conversations with characters inside my head that end up making it into a book at some stage. I've done a lot of research. You know, Leah's, her family live on an alpaca farm, so I had to do all this research about alpacas. And it's set in Brimham Rocks in North Yorkshire, which is one of my favourite places in the world. You know, it's all these incredible landscape of rocks and ferns and, you know, just these big rocks that you can climb. And so I had to go up there and spend some time there. So I've done a lot of research before I come to write. And then September, October, November, thank goodness the kids were at school during that term, because I don't know how I would have coped if I was doing homeschooling as well. But it's just a case of when they're at school, I sit down and write. If I'm not feeling it, I don't write it. You know, I have to feel connected to the characters. There's usually a period at some point where that's not coming as easily. And that's when I'm really panicking and thinking, why have I left it so late? But somehow, it, you know, year upon year, it's always come together. The sort of second half of the book, I fly through it because I'm so connected to them by this stage that I just want to see how it's all going to unfold. Even though I know, I'd still like to see how it's going to unfold and, you know, the different things that might surprise even me along the way.
What about real life events? Do they make it into the novel? I mean, I'm thinking about COVID and lockdown. Will you have a novel that features lockdown?
I don't know. You know, like, I was really wondering whether or not, because I really like my books to be realistic. I really do, you know, and sometimes that means that they're not predictable and sometimes it means that they're bittersweet and not as happy as you might want them to be. But with COVID, you know, it was a tricky one because, you know, while I like them to be set in reality, I didn't want it to also date the novel. And because, you know, I'm writing this last autumn, we just had no idea whether or not we might even be out of it by now. You know, we might sort of be at a turning point. So, I mean, the book, because it's set between like a then and now timeline, it really could be sort of set, you know, COVID could have happened somewhere in the middle, but it doesn't get a mention. And ultimately, I said to my editor, you know, I was talking to her about it, and she said, I think people want to read to escape real life. You know, they don't want to be kind of reminded of it. So I don't know, maybe in the future. I might.
Yeah, maybe it's too soon at the moment, too close. Because I suppose lockdown separation offers you possibilities as well. I mean, your novels tend to be about people coming together, but that would be a way of thwarting that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think there'll be a lot of novels written in the future, you know, looking back on COVID and, you know, looking back on this time with lockdowns and, yeah, you know, imagine trying to fall in love during this time. It would have been
exactly.
Dating is just on scale, yeah.
And Someone I Used to Know by Paige Toon is published by Simon & Schuster. We've been talking on Bookmark today to our featured guest, Ian Hood, about his debut novel, This Good Book, published by Reynard Press. Ian, what's next for you then?
The two things that I'm discussing with the publisher is a novel that I've been writing. Since I finished writing the first draft of This Good Book, there's been a lot of editing going on since then, but I've simultaneously been writing a new novel, and I'm about 30,000 words in. We'll see if that goes anywhere. I'm not really sure about it yet. But the other one that's under consideration, I think, is the novel previous to this novel, the one that got Will interested in my work. And we've had some preliminary discussions about whether that would still be something that we would look to start editing and see if it's something that we could polish up to become a publishable text.
And a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Well, in Cambridge, I'm both a member of a very wonderful writers group who have been extremely supportive to me, but I'm also a member of a book group, as many of us are. The next book we are reading is one of my suggestions, actually, and it's Alejandro Zambra's Bonsai, which is a love story and a very small text. It's about 83 pages long, but it is a novel. I love that kind of stuff about the structure of it, is also the name of it. It's a bonsai. It's a tiny little tree of a novel. But I'm also reading Jenny Fagan's Luckenbooth. You were asking about Scottish literature and how I engage with it. I've almost always got a Scottish writer's book on the go.
Thank you, Ian. We'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music. But as I say, this is the last in the current series of Bookmark. We're taking the summer to catch up on some reading. The first in the new series will be on the 12th of September, and we've already lined up some great guests to talk to. But we'll sign out now for this series and this episode with your last choice of music. It's Mogwai signing us out, of course, and this track, Drive the Nail. Why this particular one? As if I couldn't guess from the title.
It's about constructing the canvases for the paintings. She has to buy these big nails and a big hammer. The other thing about it is that it's from the most recent Mogwai album. It's funny to me because, as I've told you, the construction of it is she has these, you know, auditory hallucinations of hearing Mogwai songs before they've even been written. The point about this one being that I had completed the draft of the novel with the words Drive the Nail in the text before this album ever came out, and I ever knew that they had a song called Drive the Nail. So it seemed a strange fulfillment of my method of using the song titles in This Good Book.